I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, author most recently of The Debt Bomb, and we're going to talk about debt and what we can do about it and a few other things about the political scene. So let's get right to it. In The Debt Bomb, I mean, you lay out the situation, set it up for us. Where is the fiscal time bomb at?
Well, it's anywhere from 2 to 5 years from now, depending on what happens in Europe and what happens to world economies. But there'll be a point in time where people lose confidence in our ability to repay our debt.
So far, bond rates are low, which would signal, it seems to be that investors, people lending us money, are okay with us running up trillions and trillions of dollars of
debt.
Well,
interesting, bond interest rates are low. Mm-hmm. And that's normal in when you have a debt deleveraging. If you read long-term economic histories, mm-hmm. and you read, this time it's different, by Ken
right.
Rogoff and his co-author.
Yeah, Carmen Reinhart.
Carmen Reinhart. What you'll see is this is not uncommon.
Looking at low interest rates, that's missing the larger point.
Well, it's missing two important points. One is we're the best looking horse in the glue factory.
Right.
The second point I would make is that just because we have low interest rates doesn't mean they'll always be low. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the converse of what happens when you've printed $3.6 trillion worth of money. And once that money does get into the economy, right now it's printed, but it's not in the economy. It's sitting on banks' mm-hmm. asset listing and the Federal Reserve's asset listing. What happens is when that money starts moving, the velocity of money starts moving, you're gonna see 15, 18% inflation. So the debt bomb is two things. One, short term is deflationary. Long term is highly inflationary. And that has a real meaning to anybody that's living in our country. If you're my age or less and you have socked away something for your retirement, the purchasing value of that goes away.
Let's talk a little bit about how we got here. Since about 1950, a government on average has pulled in about 18% of GDP as revenue, it taxes the federal government, but it's been spending closer to 20% or
20,
so.
21.
Yeah. What was the role of the Republican Party under George Bush and with a Republican Congress in really pulling apart expenditures from revenue?
Both parties have equally participated in abandoning the limited role of the federal government. And you lay on top of that the careerism that politicians want to do things so they can get reelected. What you have is a catalyst that makes that even go faster. Our problems today are twofold. One is we spent money we didn't have on things we didn't absolutely need, which refers back to the enumerated powers listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
Talk a little bit about that. So what are some of the things that we spent money on? We didn't have the money for sure, but then what didn't we need that the government was spending?
Well, we've spent $2 trillion on education at the federal level with no improvement. There's no parameter you can find where we're better off. Job training programs, we spend $18 billion to almost $19 billion a year. GAO says all of them do exactly the same thing except three. Why do we have 47? Mm-hmm. 90-some teacher training programs. Where in the world did we get the authority to have teacher training programs run by the federal government? No effectiveness, no measure. We spend several $1 billion a year on those. And you can just go through the list.
But why? Yeah, I mean, but these types of lists have been generated before and nothing seems to happen.
They've been generated the first time a year ago last February. And that was the first time because I put in the balanced budget, the debt limitation, a force to make GAO put it out. When we went to ask GAO and Congressional Research Service, tell us all the programs in the federal government, they said, we can't, it's impossible. So I mandated it in a law, a must-pass law, that they had to give it to us. And we'll get the last third of that this next February.
Now, do you think when people see these long lists of programs and how much money we're spending on them and how generally useless or even unknown they are, are people going to respond and say, we got to get rid of these, or are they going to be like, I got to get in on that gravy train before
no,
it leaves
the
station?
Vast majority of Americans have common sense. It's only Washington that doesn't have any common sense. The reason things don't change is you keep sending the same people here.
Right.
And the same people are good people, but they're career politicians.
But to make it a kind of provocative statement, we should be celebrating that Dick Lugar was primaried out of office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Washington changed him. He didn't change Washington. I want to change Washington.
Do you think mandatory term limits or legally prescribed term limits are a way to go for that?
No, I think the way to do it is for individuals to say, I will not vote for you unless you put a certified statement out saying I'm limiting my terms.
And to be fair, I mean, you showed up in D.C. as part of the 94 election, the Republican Revolution. You term limited yourself out in 2000. You came back as a senator. And you've term limited yourself again, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And I'll be gone in 4 years, thank goodness.
Yeah. It can't come soon enough, Senator.
That's right.
We've got a Republican budget that was passed by the House that in 10 years will take spending from about $3.8 trillion to $4.9 trillion. The Democratic budget, at least Barack Obama's, would take that to about $5.9 trillion. Do you feel like Barack Obama and Mitt Romney are really addressing serious questions?
Well, I think there's a political calculation for all of them. Mm-hmm. I was dead serious when I said we can take $9 trillion out over the next 10 years.
Now, you've taken a huge amount of heat, from the kind of right side of the political spectrum, for putting revenue increases on the table in terms of discussing, you know, how do we fix the debt problem?
I don't have any problem taking on this issue. Our historical average in terms of revenues has been around 18%. Doesn't matter what the tax rate is, you're not going to get much higher than that, maybe up to 19.1. If you have a 70% tax rate or a 20% tax rate, you're not going to get, because people are going to avoid taxes. They're not going to evade them. They're going to avoid them. They're going to do things that make them pay. So 18% is about what we can get to. If you really think, given this country's makeup today, that you could get 60 Tom Coburns in the Senate to where you could actually cut the spending enough and reform the entitlements to where you wouldn't have to have it, and you could get the government down to 15% of GDP, I'm all for it. But if that's the case, I have a whole bunch of spoiled land in Oklahoma I'd like to sell you for $10,000 an acre, because there's no truth to that. The fact is our founders made this country where if you're going to change something, you have to do it based on compromise. And we're going to have increased revenue. That doesn't mean increased tax rates. And actually, the increased revenues will come from the dynamic effect of lowering the rates and broadening the base and getting some of the $2.6 trillion that's sitting on the sidelines right now in businesses invested, and that will create jobs.
Entitlements is where the big money is in a lot of
Well, places, a lot of people right? say that, but you know, $1 trillion a year in discretionary spending is big money, especially when 30% of it, 30 to 35% of it's waste, fraud, or duplication.
Just
take that. If it's 35%, that's $350 billion a year, that's $3.5 trillion. Right. I mean, if you truly ran the government efficiently, and that's not talking about things that are done outside of the purview of the enumerated powers. Mm-hmm. If you did that, you'd cut another $150 billion. That's $5 trillion over 10 years. Then if you fix entitlements,
I feel like you make mostly minor trims to entitlements. You're talking about changing eligibility ages and things like that. How do we fix Medicare change it? So, I mean, and is Medicare something that gives essentially free or reduced price health care to seniors, irrespective largely of income? You know, is that something that we should be doing?
Well, the question is it constitutional? Mm-hmm. I would have to say it's outside of the enumerated powers. Mm-hmm. That's number one. So is Medicaid.
Yeah.
Social Security, if you wanted to create a system where the Social Security actually was set up independent and people could put their mm-hmm. funds into it and they could do it, that's all constitutional. You can do that.
Okay.
But the point is if they were all self-financing, you wouldn't have any of the problems with it.
Right.
But the political class has changed it from
so self-finance. what's your best fix for Medicare?
You can't fix Medicare unless you fix health care. Mm-hmm. And the best fix is to let free market forces work on health care. Mm-hmm. And therefore, what Richard Burr and I have proposed in terms of the Seniors' Choice Act, where you have a way where you have a premium support system, and you in fact connect purchase with payment and allow individuals to be involved. There's great corollaries in the private sector, and even our private sector doesn't have real market forces.
How do we get to that market-based system? And I know that you agree that, you know, markets have delivered great increases in productivity and service and treatments in every aspect of our lives. They can do it in Medicare, in medicine. You're a doctor, you recognize that. But how do we get there? Because the resistance is humongous, it seems, towards moving towards a system where the patient is actually in charge of spending money.
Well, how you get there is to contrast what's going to happen if you don't change. And the question you ask a senior that's on Medicare today, do you want Medicare not to change, knowing that your children and your grandchildren will have a markedly lower standard of living if we don't change it? That's how you get there. Number two is you have to have transparency in outcomes and quality in medicine, which we don't. Unless you're a doctor, you know, I often ask the question, why do only the doctors know the bad doctors? Mm-hmm. Why isn't there a transparent market in terms of quality and service? If you want to get a complicated operation, do you really want to go to somebody that does it twice a year or 200 mm-hmm. times a year? Mm-hmm. Which place do you go? Where
do we start? Because the information, I mean, there's such a thing as the American Medical Association.
Well, the American Medical Association represents less than 100,000 doctors in this country.
But I think don't they represent fully, you know, 99% of Congress? I mean, if I created a system to rate doctors publicly or rate my professor for doctors, would that be allowed or would that be pushed back?
Sure, you have Consumer Reports out there right now. Mm-hmm. You could have a Consumer Reports on healthcare. The fact is what here's the problem in healthcare. People in healthcare don't want transparency because we have a system that pays based on the more you do, the more you earn, rather than the quality of outcome and paying you for prevention. Market forces aren't perfect, mm-hmm. but I'll guarantee you they're better than what we're doing now. And when you have a Medicaid system where the outcomes are worse than if you have no insurance at all, where 40%...
Which is stunning. And dilate on that point a little bit, because Medicaid is not just an inefficient program. It's actually a disastrous
program.
It's
a lower quality program that says you have access when you really have no access, or you have access to inferior quality. And so there's ways to fix all that.
And in the book, you talk about turning Medicaid into block grants that go back to the states.
Let the states figure it out.
And you don't have a problem with a social welfare net that is supplied by the government.
No. I also mentioned in the book a book by a guy by the name of Marvin Olasky called The Tragedy of American Compassion. What we have done through the federal government is enhance dependency. We've taught learned dependency versus earned success. And if we would use the principles outlined by Marvin Olasky in our safety net programs, what we would see is much lower cost and much better outcomes. One of the things we're doing with our social safety net is keeping people down. We're actually harming them.
In the book, I think you write at one point, government can do justice, but it can't do charity.
That's
what you're talking about. Now, to go back to Medicare and Social Security, should we get rid of them then? Because not all seniors need them. And wouldn't it make more sense to transform old age entitlements, which come about because you reach a certain age, instead of that, shouldn't it just be based on income at whatever age?
Well, there may be a point in time where we can accomplish that, but the fact is we have a very large number of Americans, in excess of 50 million, that have planned their future based on that system. So whatever change you have, what you have to do is, there's been a contract made with seniors,
right. And
you can't abandon that contract, but you can make that contract much more efficient and much more effective so that the future of our kids is not mortgaged.
Do you find that that's actually a persuasive line to?
Absolutely.
Because like it's geezers who are getting a lot out of things now and they might have the power, right?
Well, the contrast is, you know, being a grandfather myself, I actually can relate to them. Mm-hmm. They would like to keep Medicare just like it is.
Right.
But if you ask the question, change Medicare or don't change Medicare, but if you change Medicare, I will actually do something for my grandkids.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you ask a very wealthy individual, will you pay more taxes? They say, absolutely. But I don't want it to be spent, I want it to pay down the debt.
Right.
It's exactly the same thing. Seniors don't mind making a sacrifice. Remember, this country's done hard things, and most of the seniors were involved in doing those hard things. They're willing to do hard things again, but they want to know that it's done for a noble cause.
Well, now you've taken a huge amount of heat, from the kind of right side of the political spectrum when you started criticizing defense spending. What do we need to do to right-size defense spending?
Well, first of all, we have to figure out how we buy things. We want advanced weaponry and major weapon programs. Those are important things for us, how we buy them. There's no adults in the room. What Eisenhower said about the military-industrial complex is true. And
this is that essentially that when we, you know, when we have a long-standing army and a military, the people who sell military hardware and personnel, I mean, are just going to get more and more powerful because they effectively own Congress.
Well, think about what happens. Think about how we do it now versus how you might do it as a personal purchase yourself. How we do it now is we come up with an idea of what we want. And then we offer a contract that's no, it's cost plus. It's not a fixed bid. And so we have a formulation of an idea. We have a cost plus contract. And then Joe, your brother, says, well, why don't we do this too? Mm-hmm. And Jack over here says, well, why don't we do this too? And so all of a sudden what you had was a good idea that we started out on, with a defense contractor saying, well, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we can do that. And we're on a cost plus contract, so they have a conflict of interest of doing more. Right. And no adult in the room says, well, what was our original requirement to begin with?
In 2010, I guess it was, you called for a freeze on defense spending. And then in 2008, you said that it was a mistake that we went into Iraq. There's two issues with defense spending or military spending. One is, what we buy and how we go about buying it, and then what we want the military to do. How are those two issues related, and have your ideas about what America's role in the world in terms of projecting military force, how have those changed, especially in your second tour back?
Well, I think the number one thing is, if you look at history, you have the military might based on what your economic might is. Mm-hmm. Our economic might is at risk. So it doesn't matter what our philosophical positions are, we're not going to be able to fund them.
What are some of the things that we're doing? I mean, was Iraq a mistake in terms of protecting our national
security interests?
Well, I think
history's going to show it was a mistake.
Yeah.
It's not what Tom Coburn says. It's right. You're going to look back and you say, what did you accomplish? Did we, in fact, stop the proliferation of Al-Qaeda by going into Iraq? No, because Al-Qaeda was working at places other than Iraq.
But now, did we stop Al-Qaeda by staying in Afghanistan as long as we did, or was that a mistake as well? Or how did we stop?
I don't think I can judge that. I think we're going to judge that after we've left. Mm-hmm. And you're going across two administrations with different right. policies and different viewpoints. So I think ultimately what you're going to see is the power of ideas is more powerful than the power of weapons. Mm-hmm. And where America led the world and can lead the world again is in the power of ideas. People being aspirational towards our values, our rule of law, our freedom, our liberty, our limited government. And we're clouding that picture by sometimes what we do. My foreign policy is not limited in its expertise. But I actually believe the Constitution. I actually don't believe we ought to get involved in things unless we have a direct national security.
So something with, say, what's going on in Syria now, we should stand on the sidelines.
Well, if we want to help arm people to fight for themselves, I have no problem with that. We should not be directly involved in Syria.
Do you feel that this is something that conservatives are coming around to?
I really don't know the answer to it. People have all sorts of views. What we do is we learn from mistakes, and we ought not to close our eyes and ears to that. And I think there's lots to be learned over the last 10 years. You know, it's like Homeland Security. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year on Homeland Security. Can anybody guarantee us we're not going to be attacked again? No. Can we lessen that to a significant degree? Yes. For each additional dollar we put in, what do we get in return? So having that conversation, you've never heard a president have that conversation with American people. There are risks out there. We can do so much, but if we spend additional dollars here, we may de minimis reduction in risk versus if we spent the same amount of money trying to cure breast cancer, we'd get a whole lot better event.
You were one of the original authors of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, and you cited the Commerce Clause as the justification for that.
Yeah.
So how does the Commerce Clause apply? You know, and we're talking here not even about abortion per se, but which level of government, is it state, local, federal, deal with it? Why does the Commerce Clause apply in the partial birth abortion?
The same way it might apply on an equal rights amendment or mm-hmm. the civil rights
okay.
movement.
Talk about that a bit
well,
more.
What you're talking about is Go back to our founding documents. We're endowed by our Creator. Pursuit of life, pursuit of happiness. You cannot pursue life if we've said we can take your life at our whim.
Okay.
So it really is a more fundamental issue than the Commerce Clause. Commerce Clause was just in that bill as a reference.
So, I mean, and obviously you also talked with Justice Kagan about this during her hearings. But, I mean, you come from a natural rights tradition, so that, yeah. In fact, you would be against abortion in all circumstances.
Except to save the life of a mother.
Well, right. Okay, yeah. Which is the one... I think that is the one exception that everybody on every side of the issue agrees with, because that's in longstanding.
Yeah.
Okay. Over your political career, you've been a staunch social conservative as well as a fiscal conservative. In your first, when you were a congressman, you supported the V-chip legislation, which I know from a libertarian perspective, we saw that as Big Brother run amok. It was mandatory hardware and TV so that parents could block certain shows. You had a big controversy.
Yeah, but there's a difference there. Parents didn't have to block. It gave them the opportunity to block.
Okay, but it's still a mandate on TV manufacturers.
That's right, just like we have a mandate that you have a safety cord on a coffee pot.
Okay.
That you're not electrocuted when the coffee spills.
Although it seems a lot different than saying Bugs Bunny might be.
But it's the same thing.
Well,
the point is it's creating an opportunity for you to be safe.
Okay. What I was working towards is, you've been an outspoken social conservative. You're against abortion. You're against certain types of public displays. You had a fairly controversial take on the airing of Schindler's List when you were a congressman. More in the Senate race in 2004 in Oklahoma, you made comments made about lesbianism in public schools in Oklahoma, caused the controversy. Do you feel, and yet in the book, one of the things that is I found genuinely interesting is that you're not walking away from any of your positions, but it seems like your attitude towards the government's role in enforcing values is shifting. And at one point you write, laws are pretty important, but they're not the most important thing. And that's in a chapter where you're talking about what the religious right needs to learn or has learned. And do you feel on a certain level, not that you're walking away from what you believe, but that government is not the best instrument for pushing particular values throughout society?
It obviously it isn't, because it hadn't done a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
I would answer you yes. The problem comes is, what were the values that the country was based on?
Mm-hmm.
I hold through my study and reading, whether you read the Federalist Papers or you read about our founders, it's like de Tocqueville said, this country won't last if it's not seen as a moral country,
mm-hmm.
as a good country. And one of the things that makes it, gives us value, is we put value into principles and character, and the character of the country. You know, as you rationalize away standards of decency or standards of behavior, regardless of your of a libertarian viewpoint or not, the fact is those have consequences. And those consequences will impact the country. And the question is will it impact it positively or negative? The main answer to your question is do you live a life that models the behavior that you think best represents what our founders believed in? And so it goes back to the question on leadership. You know, can you tell kids that it's fine to use drugs? I want to smoke pot. It's fine. No problem with that. No problem. Even though what we know medically in terms of pot smoking is it's a disaster for kids. And it's a disaster for the adults that use it. You know, that's what we know medically. It's not disputed.
What about alcohol?
Same thing. The point is because you have one and you've rationalized one, does that mean you rationalize another one?
Although, would you be open, and we needn't take up too much time on this, to a cost-benefit analysis of what are the costs of marijuana prohibition versus the benefits? Because you could always lobby or argue against marijuana use, even if it's freely available, say, in the same way that liquor or wine is.
Yeah, as long as you can figure out a way to measure it, which you can't.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is it's the same thing with our dependency issue in terms of creating dependency in this country. I mean, we're getting ready to issue a report on the number of people that are on disability insurance that we're also collecting unemployment.
Right.
I mean, you know, hundreds of thousands of people collecting them both at the same time, which they're not eligible for. But what we did was, well, it's, don't worry about it. It's okay. No problem.
And well, and you talk about that the fiscal crisis is a moral crisis.
It is a moral
crisis.
And
in this sense, it's because people are not holding themselves accountable any more than they're holding their
leaders
accountable. That's
right. What we've done is undermined individual responsibility and self-reliance in this country. Not, we didn't mean to, but we have. And if you look at Rome, if you look at Greece, if you look at every other republic in history, they died the same way. So this isn't rocket science. Go look at what happened to them. And so I'm not for undermining any more of our cultural values. I don't have to be right, but I do have the right to stand for what I believe is right. And so I'm willing to speak on those issues. You can carry the libertarian thought all the way down to nil, is you have no responsibility to pay any taxes. I mean, you know, how do you have a societal form where you don't participate? I'm checking out. So the point is, it's great to think about, but it doesn't solve any of our real problems today. And the real problems today are real. They're coming soon. The effects of them are going to be disastrous on a large quantity of Americans. We ought to be solving those now rather than putting it off and waiting for the election to happen.
And just as a final comment, in the book you talk about the rise of the Tea Party as the most important thing since the 1994 revolution, Republican Revolution. Why is that? And do you think the Tea Party clearly had a major effect in 2010? Is it going to have that kind of effect in 2012 and beyond?
Yes. And it's not, quote, Tea Party. It's the fact that people have gotten involved. They actually know what the Constitution says, and they say, why aren't we following it? And so what you've seen is the spontaneous growth of a group of people that said, I've had enough. I've seen all this excess, all this waste of big government. What does our Constitution say? How about embracing what got us here in the first place and going back to what we know works? And so I'm proud of those. There's extremes on any group, but the vast majority of Tea Party people are hardworking Americans that know, have common sense, and know what the value of America is and would like to see it secured.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Senator Tom Coburn. The book is The Debt Bomb, A Bold Plan to Stop Washington from Bankrupting America. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.